religion will be exalted. The first day of the week, a common working day, possessing no sanctity, whatever, will be set up as was the image of Babylon. It will be set up as was the image of Babylon. All nations and tongues and peoples will be commanded to worship the spurious Sabbath. This is Satan's plan to make of no account the day instituted by God and to give to the world and given to the world as a memorial of creation. The decree enforcing the worship of this day is to go forth to all the world. In a limited degree, it has already gone forth. In several places, the civil power is speaking with the voice of a dragon, just as the heathen king spoke to the Hebrew captives. Trial and persecution will come to all who, in obedience to the word of God, refuse to worship this false Sabbath. Force is the last resort of every false religion. At first it tries attraction, as the king of Babylon tried the power of music and outward show. If these attractions, invented by men inspired by Satan, failed to make men worship the image, the hungry flames of the furnace were ready to consume them. So it will be now. The papacy has exercised her power to compel men to obey her, and she will continue to do so. We need the same spirit that was manifested by God's servants in the conflict with paganism. So as the image was set up in the days of Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar, so it will be set up again in the enforcement of Sunday worship in the last days. Thereby we can recognize quite readily that the book of Daniel is a preview of the experience of God's folk in the last days. It tells us that only those who, like Daniel, learn God's ways and become true Sabbath keepers can be successful in that final conflict. This then must be the most important work of our lives from day to day. Let's now look at Daniel chapter 3 and we begin to read it from verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 80 cubits and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together the princes, the governors and the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. Then the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together unto the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. And whoso falleth not down and worshippeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace." Therefore at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations and the languages, fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Now I should have counted, and it would be worth our while to count, the number of times in this chapter already it's emphasized again and again that this image had been made by or set up by King Nebuchadnezzar. It's there in verse 1, for instance, where it says, the king made an image of gold. In verse 3, again it says, the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. It's repeated again in verse 5, the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Again we find this in verse 7. So there's 4 or 5 times in which that thought is emphasized again and again. Now not only had Nebuchadnezzar set the image up, but furthermore, he had made the plan that every one of the peoples of the entire world should come and worship the image according to his plan or his dictates. This is very significant in view of the fact that we're concerned with the ways of God versus the ways of men, the ways of Babylon distinct from the ways of Jesus Christ. We've been emphasizing that God is the plan maker. this, of course, he truly is to those who accept him as such. And the only person to whom we should ever look for the making of plans in our lives, here we find as man here, ourselves, is to look to God and God alone for those plans. The sister what appeals to us in the book Ministry of Healing, page 479, first of all, on page 478, she says, "We have not wisdom to plan our own lives." The next page, "Let God plan for you." And Christ, our great example, of course, looked to God and to God alone as his plan maker. Now then, in the image God had laid out before Nebuchadnezzar, in the stone cut out of the mountain without hands, he showed Nebuchadnezzar God's plans for Nebuchadnezzar's future. Whereas in the image, God showed to Nebuchadnezzar what would be the sure outworking of his own plans if he refused to accept the plans of God. So, so far as Nebuchadnezzar was concerned, then God invited him to accept God the Father as being the plan maker. But instead of that, what did Nebuchadnezzar do? He began to make his own plans. Instead of accepting the declining value of the image, he said to himself, "I will build an image of my own devising." How much of God's plans was there in the erection of the image upon the plains of Jura, an image made of gold? How much of God's plans?
No.
Nothing whatsoever. How much of Nebuchadnezzar's plans? It was totally Nebuchadnezzar's plan. Now, not only did Nebuchadnezzar replace God's plans in his own life by his own plans, but characteristically of Babylon, he determined to set himself up as the plan maker for the entire world. And so we'll just now put the, the word king rather than the great long word Nebuchadnezzar. I might spell it wrong anyway. So here is King Nebuchadnezzar, and he made himself to be his own plan maker in the place of God the plan maker. So he imposed upon himself his own plans. Now, not only so, but upon all the peoples of the earth, Nebuchadnezzar was determined to be their plan maker. So he called them and they came. Even Meshach, Shadrach and Abednego came too, so there was nothing wrong with coming. And when he got them there, he said, "Now I've built this image, I have set it up." And that thought, as we've seen, is repeated again and again in these verses. And now the king said to the people, "I have made a plan, you will obey my plan. If you don't obey my plan, you'll fry for it in the burning fire, in the burning fiery furnace." And of course, being burned alive was not the kind of prospect that people looked forward to. So when the music sounded forth, just like a harvest going down before the scythe, those tens of thousands of people bowed before the image. What a gratifying sight it must have been to King Nebuchadnezzar. Because literally he was making himself to be God upon this earth. I think we should very appropriately read at this point 2 Thessalonians 2, which describes the characteristic of the papacy of Babylon, of the man of sin, and shows that that characteristic, of course, is to make himself to be God in the place of God. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, we might begin to read in verse 3. Well, we start with verse 1 to get the context, I think it would be more value. "Now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, and by our gathering together unto him, that you be not soon shaken in mind or be troubled, neither by spirit, nor by word, nor by letter as from us, as that the day of Christ is at hand. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, all that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God." Now that's the papacy. That's Babylon. And what did Nebuchadnezzar do in regard to the peoples of the world back at that time except make himself to be God to them? Their plan maker, their director, the one who should decide what they should do, instead of men looking to God and to God alone for direct guidance. We must never forget the principle that's laid out in the book Acts of the Apostles, when we're plainly told that God is the leader of his people. Just note the statement with you quickly here. It talks about the fact that the church leaders in Jerusalem had forgotten a very important principle, and it reads as follows: these men have lost sight of the fact that God is the teacher of his people, that every worker in his cause is to obtain individual experience in following the divine leader, not looking to man for direct guidance, that his workers are to be molded and fashioned not after man's ideas, but after the similitude of the divine. Now we ask ourselves a simple question: who had become the teacher of the people in Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom? God or Nebuchadnezzar? Nebuchadnezzar had. Was every person obtaining an individual experience in following the divine leader, or were they following a man upon this earth in the place of a divine leader? And the answer, of course, is very, very obvious. The people back there, the workers of Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, were being molded and fashioned after man's ideas, not after the similitude of the divine. When Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego found themselves in a situation, they found themselves in the identical situation in which Christ found himself and Paul found himself later on. And right now I want to compare these three experiences. We'll take the experience of Jesus Christ first, then we'll look quickly at the experience of Paul, and then we'll come back to look at the experience of Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego. The experience of Christ came to a particular head after the feeding of the 5,000. I believe we talked about this the last time I was here. But I want to review it today in this parallelism between these three incidents: Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, Jesus Christ, and later in the experience of Paul. And we'll see the outworking of each of these three individual experiences. In the chapter called A Night on the Lake, page 377 in the book Desire of Ages, we have the picture of tremendous faith and enthusiasm which possessed the Jews and the disciples after the feeding of the 5,000. I'll read now some of this information for our study this afternoon. Seated upon the grassy plain in the twilight of the spring evening, the people ate of the food that Christ had provided. The words they had heard that day had come to them as the voice of God. The works of healing they had witnessed were such as only divine power could perform. But the miracle of the loaves appealed to everyone in that vast multitude. All were sharers in its benefits. In the days of Moses, God had fed Israel with manna in the desert, and who was this that had fed them that day but he whom Moses had foretold? No human power could create from 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes food sufficient to feed thousands of hungry people. And they said one to another, "This is of a truth that prophet that should come into the world." Now let me ask you the very simple question: did those people that day, at that point of time, according to these words, have a very definite faith in Jesus Christ? They did. They very obviously did. Now we're told in Scripture that faith without works is dead. Let's move a little further now to read more about their faith. All day the conviction has strengthened. That crowning act is the assurance that the long-looked-for deliverer is among them. The hopes of the people rise higher and higher. This is he who will make Judea an earthly paradise, a land flowing with milk and honey. Does that sound like faith? Right? He can satisfy every desire. He can break the power of the hated Romans. He can deliver Judah and Jerusalem. He can heal the soldiers who are wounded in battle. He can supply whole armies with food. He can conquer the nations and give to Israel the long sought for dominion. So without question, those people at that point of time very definitely had a very strong faith in Christ's power and in who Christ was. Both those things. They said, "This is of a truth that prophet that should come into the world." That was a strong belief in who Jesus Christ actually was. And then it goes on in the next paragraph to talk about what Christ could do. He could break the power of the Romans. He can deliver Judah and Jerusalem. He can heal the soldiers wounded in battle. And Christ could do all those things. So there was faith in what Christ could do. Who he was and what he could do was very clear in their minds that day. Now, before Christ came to the world, the Jews were in a very, very serious predicament. They were in bondage to the hated Romans, and they longed for deliverance from that situation. And furthermore, God likewise wished to see them set free, so they returned to the building up of God's kingdom. Now, the trouble was that they worked out on God's behalf a solution to their problem, from which solution they lacked only one thing, and that is the power to make it work. And that is where, in their thinking, the Messiah entered upon the scene. He had the power. He would take their plan and he would make that plan work. Now, we move a little further in our story. We now see that these Israelites, the disciples and the Jews back in those days, certainly went to work in regard to their problem. So there was works with their faith. Now let's read about those works. In their enthusiasm, the people are ready at once to crown him king. They see that he makes no effort to attract attention or secure honour to himself. In this, he is essentially different from the priests and rulers, and they fear that he will never urge his claim to David's throne. Consulting together, they agree to take him by force and proclaim him the king of Israel. Right? So they consulted together, they formed the plan, and they agree to take Christ by force and proclaim him the king of Israel. The disciples unite with the multitude in declaring the throne of David the rightful inheritance of their master. It is the modesty of Christ, they say, that causes him to refuse such honour. Let the people exalt their deliverer. Let the arrogant priests and rulers be forced to honour him who comes clothed with the authority of heaven. They eagerly arrange to carry out their purpose. Now, did they have works?
Yes.
Certainly. This was works. But whose works?
Their works.
Wasn't God's works. In other words, we'll put Christ's name down here now. And Jesus Christ looked to God and God alone as his plan maker, as I read to you from Isaiah pages 208 and Ministry of Healing page 479. Now God's plan did not involve Christ being seated upon a temporal throne in a literal Jerusalem with a golden crown upon his head. That wasn't God's plan. Now the people, that is the disciples and the Jews together at that feeding of the 5,000, they consulted together and they made a plan for Christ. And they were determined to replace God's plan with their plan. Now, can you now see the exact similarity between Nebuchadnezzar's course and the course of the Jews and the disciples? Nebuchadnezzar made a plan to replace God's plan, an image all of gold in the place of the stone that was grown to a great mountain. And likewise, these disciples and the Jews formed in their minds and determined to carry out a plan that would replace God's plan for Jesus Christ. Now, can you see the exact similarity in both cases? It's clear, isn't it? Good. Now then, let's pursue this thought of faith without works is dead. So when those disciples had faith and they had works, then what would you expect to find? A continuation of strong belief. But instead of that, we find that when Christ sends them away and refuses to be part of that plan, that dark unbelief possesses their mind, and for as I read on page 380, they came to the place where they questioned, could Christ be an imposter as the Pharisees asserted? So, there was faith, there was works, and then there was unbelief. And unbelief, of course, is dead, or faith has gone, has been put to death. So what is wrong with the text in James when James says, faith without works is dead? Because here is faith, here is works, and here is death. Or the loss of, or faith that turned to death. So very obviously, how are we to understand the words of James? We understand that when James talks about works, then what kind of works is he talking about? Man's works or God's works? God's works. So faith without God's works is dead, which means that faith with man's works, which is faith without God's works, is also dead, as is plainly brought to view in that particular situation. Now, Jesus Christ now found himself being called upon to either continue looking to God and God alone as his plan maker, or to look to those Jews and those disciples as his plan maker. That was the test imposed upon Christ that day. And is that not the same test that was imposed upon Meshach, Shadrach and Abednego back here? They had to choose between whether they would look to God as their plan maker or to King Nebuchadnezzar as their plan maker. Now Jesus Christ absolutely refused in any way at all to let other men be his plan maker. And so he dismissed the multitude and his disciples and sent them on their way and refused to enter into their plan in any shape or form whatsoever. Now if Christ had yielded to human beings as his plan maker in the least degree, then what would have been the outcome of his mission? The image tells you, doesn't it? The image tells you. Because the image shows that those nations which are built under the jurisdiction of men who make plans for other men come to disaster and failure. If Christ had built his kingdom in the same way, it would have failed as surely as did Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, and the nations from that day down to this. Then move on to the Apostle Paul before we come back to the experience of Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, because this is a lesson of the very, very greatest importance. Okay, there it is. Just need to have this space in here, and we now add the experience of Paul. That's on this page. Right, so we have these three pictures over here. Here's the king over the king and the people. We have Christ with the Jews and disciples who are trying to rule his life. And here we come last of all, of course, the experience of Paul in the situation there at Jerusalem. Throughout the experience of Paul as a missionary and a minister, there was a persistent effort, for a short time dropped by the leading brethren, but again picked up again, to impose upon him their authority and their will. I read now from page 401, well first of all from page 400 in regard to this, where it says, in their anxiety to preserve a few meaningless forms and ceremonies, they had lost sight of the blessing that would come to them and to the cause they loved through an effort to unite in one all parts of the Lord's work. Now, of course, the they referred to were James, the brother of Jesus Christ, as the half-brother of Christ, and the leading brethren in the Christian Church of Jerusalem. Although desirous of safeguarding the best interests of the Christian Church, they had failed to keep step with the advancing providences of God, and in their human wisdom attempted to throw about workers many unnecessary restrictions. Thus there arose a group of men who were unacquainted personally with the changing circumstances and peculiar needs met by labourers in distant fields, yet who insisted that they had the authority to direct their brethren in these fields to follow certain specified methods of labour. They felt as if the work of preaching the gospel should be carried forward in harmony with their opinions. Now let's just follow those last two sentences through again, because this was what developed in the early Christian church. It said, here are these leading brethren who insisted. Now, was King Nebuchadnezzar a person who insisted on having his way? Right? Now the point is, of course, that King Nebuchadnezzar, being an absolute monarch, could back up his insistence by the power of force and compel men to do as he said. But in the early Christian church, of course, it wasn't quite so simple for these men to get their way. But just the same, even though they could not enforce their way, they insisted that they had the authority to direct their brethren in these fields to follow certain specified methods of labour. They felt as if the work of preaching the gospel should be carried forward in harmony with their opinions. Now, after the great council in Jerusalem, recorded in Acts the 15th chapter, we find that these men had a change of hearts. On page 401, they had a reversion, as I now read. Afterward, when it became apparent that the converts among the Gentiles were increasing rapidly, there were a few of the leading brethren at Jerusalem who began to cherish anew their former prejudices against the methods of Paul and his associates. These prejudices strengthened with the passing of the years until some of the leaders determined that the work of preaching the gospel must henceforth be conducted in accordance with their own ideas. Note that. Until some of the leaders determined that the work of preaching the gospel must henceforth be conducted in accordance with their own ideas. If Paul would conform his methods to certain policies which they advocated, they would acknowledge and sustain his work. Otherwise, they could no longer look upon it with favour or grant it their support. Now, once again, we have an identical situation. Here is Paul, and here were these leaders in Jerusalem, together with James, the half-brother of Jesus Christ. And these men insisted that Paul look away from God as his plan maker to themselves as plan makers. Now, I hope you can see today that what Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego faced there in the kingdom of Babylon, what Christ faced after the feeding of the 5,000, and what Paul faced in Jerusalem are three identical situations. Well, it's the same situation. I shouldn't say two identical situations. It's the same situation in all three cases. Now, let's do the outworking of each of these three situations. First of all, we find that Paul yielded at last to their pressure. And when they said to him, "We have a plan, we want you to follow our plan and go down to the temple and offer the sacrifice," and Paul went and offered the sacrifice, what was the outworking of their human plan? Disaster. Paul's ministry was cut very, very short. In fact, we're told in this book, Acts the Apostles, on page 417, that God had not ordained that Paul's labour should so soon end, but he did not work a miracle to counteract the train of circumstances to which the course of the leaders in the Church of Jerusalem had given rise. I wonder how many more years would have gone by before Paul's ministry would normally have ended. Out of 10, out of 20, who knows? No doubt God planned for him to come to a very ripe old age, as John the Beloved did, to die a natural death and to exert tremendous influence of power in the Christian church. But because men took the place of God as the plan maker, what became of the ministry of Paul? He was cut off. And the way was open for the full development of the mystery of iniquity in the Christian church at that time. Now, did Jesus, like Paul, yield in the least particular to this pressure? He did not. He stood steadfast and said, "God alone is my plan maker. No committee of men, no individuals, no man upon this earth is going to divert me from the plan which God has made for my life, and to God and God alone I look as my source." And what was the result? Christ came to the end of his ministry and could say with confidence and faith, "It is finished." And he bowed his head and died a victor over the powers of darkness. Never once in the least degree compromising that noble principle of the mystery of the gospel, the principle that builds the kingdom of God. Now let's come back now and look at Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego and see what was the outworking of this test so far as they were concerned. We'll now start again with verse 8. We left off with verse 7 previously. And here it says, "Wherefore at that time certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews, and that they spake and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, 'O king, live forever.'" Now when they said, "O king, live forever," then they were literally saying to the king, "Now king, we are heartily in accord with the principles for which you're standing. We believe that you should make plans for us in the place of the God of heaven. And we accept you as our plan maker, and we believe in that system is eternal life for both you and for ourselves." That's what they were saying when they said those words, "O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth, that he should be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom they are set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, these men, O king, have not regarded thee, they serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Now comes the king's reaction. Now why should the king be disturbed when, shall we say, 10,000 men, that's just a wild guess on my part, of course, we don't know how many of those governors were there, it might be much less than that, representing millions of people throughout the world, had all bowed down to serve the king and to do his will, and now only three young men stand out and refuse to bow before the king. Well, he should have said to himself, what does that amount to? Three? I shouldn't worry about three people. Why should they constitute any kind of threat to my kingdom and to my rule? But if there's one thing that Satan's kingdom cannot stand, it's any kind of opposition to its cause. And Satan impressed upon the mind of King Nebuchadnezzar quite rightfully that those three men actually constituted a threat to the Babylonian way far beyond the numbers that they were. The fact that there are three men was not the important thing. It's the power of the principle which they stood that was the important thing. And three men within whom is the way of God and the Spirit of God are more than a match for a million Babylonians. I believe that. And so it proved. Because all the power of Nebuchadnezzar was not able to force those men to worship the image nor to take away their lives on that historic occasion. And Nebuchadnezzar seemed to perceive that there is a rather special issue of critical importance in this whole drama. Here in the Bible commentary it says on page 1169 of volume 4, he felt that it required more than ordinary power to deal with these devil men. His mind was strongly impressed that something unusual would interpose in their behalf, and his strongest men were ordered to deal with them. So King Nebuchadnezzar knew that he wasn't just dealing with three men. He was dealing with a power, with a principle that would prove too much for him to contain. And no doubt his mind was called back to remember the power of Daniel's present past in the image. And even though he had gone ahead boldly and set up this golden image, in his heart there were some very, very serious misgivings, some very, very real fears, a very, very real concern that what God said would happen was going to happen after all. Verse 13, chapter 3, then Nebuchadnezzar in his rage and fury commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Do not you serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Now, if you be ready, that at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the image which I have made, well, that if you worship not, you shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace, and who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? What a challenge. Now I appreciate beyond words the answer which those three young men gave to King Nebuchadnezzar. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. I don't hear them saying, O king, live forever, do you? I didn't subscribe to that idea. Now they said, if it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king, but if not, be it known to thee, O king, that we will not serve thy God, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Oh my, it sounds very simple on paper, doesn't it? But imagine that day when three young men standing, and as far as the eye could see, there was this vast crowd of people, of important governors and legislators and rulers and so forth, every one of them craning and straining to hear what these young men would have to say. And every one of them collectively exerting a tremendous collective pressure on these three young men to yield. And there was the king desperately afraid now of losing face, determined to display his authority and rage. And these three young men calmly look back at him and say, "O king, do it your will. Throw us to the burning fire furnace. Maybe God will deliver us, maybe he won't. We have a problem, and the problem is our lives are threatened. We've given that problem to God, and whatever solution he works out is fully acceptable to us. If God's solution is we perish, we perish. If God's solution is to deliver us, we'll be delivered. But whichever way, O king, let it be known, we are not going to subscribe to your principles and ways. We are not going to accept you as our plan maker. We look to God and God alone as the guide of our lives. Throw us in the furnace. We don't mind." Now that must have been, if the king was mad before, he must have been really mad now. Just appreciate how it must have stirred his kingly wrath. And so it says in verse 19, "Then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury, and the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spake and commanded that they should heat the furnace 1 7 times more than it was wont to be heated." Now, I'm often wondering how they did that. I guess they just threw a lot more fuel in to stir it up. But there is, of course, a limit to a furnace's capacity to take in fuel after it begins to choke, but they must have had some method of making it burn 7 times hotter. I guess they had no thermometers back in those days, so how they know it was exactly 7 times hotter anyway. But it was much hotter for certain. "And he commanded the most mighty men that went in the army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their hosen, and their hats, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent, and the furnace exceeding hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace." Now, at this point, of course, no doubt everyone must have said, "Well, what a sad waste of good humanity. Too bad those poor guys were so stubborn. If they only had a little bit of sense and reason, they'd at least save their life. What did they gain by wasting that precious spark of life, all for nothing, there in that burning fiery furnace?" Now, as we know, of course, the king now was amazed to find that those three men didn't die. Verse 24, "Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astonished, and rose up in haste and spake and said unto his counselors, Did not we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? Then answered and said, They answered unto the king, True, O king. He answered and said, Lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." Now, Sister White says that the reason why the king was able to recognize Jesus Christ as being the Son of God is because Meshach, Shadrach, Abednego, and Daniel had revealed God to him through their lives of righteous obedience to God's commands. And that was a very wonderful and precious witness to make at that point of time. Now, I know with interest that those three men did not come out of the burning fire first until the king called them out. They stayed right there until he called them out. He put them in. They were his subjects. He was the king of the land. And as Christ later said, "Render unto Caesar the thing which is Caesar, and to God that which is God." So those men would obey the king while it was not a violation of principle. And it wasn't a violation of principle to walk around in the burning fiery furnace under God's protection. Quite a unique achievement, of course. So the king called them to come to the image. They came, but they wouldn't bow, because to bow is beyond the right of the king to demand that they do that. The king put them in the furnace, and they went in the furnace. They didn't resist. I guess they'd have walked in there if the king had told them to. And now they were in there, they would stay there until the king called them out. And when the king called them out, they came, thus showing that they were not in rebellion against the king as the king. But they would not obey the king when the king tried to take God's place over them. And first, in verse 26, we read that the king Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spake and said, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you servants of the Most High God, come forth and come hither." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth of the mist of the fire. Now, once again, what kind of conclusion was achieved in this whole thing? Was it clear cut? Was it an absolutely unequivocal win for God's side? It certainly was. And is that not the pattern which we've seen established so far throughout the book of Daniel? In every story we've seen so far, the people of God come out clear winners. They experienced no such thing as failure, loss, impossibility, or defeat. The only thing burning in the furnace was King Nebuchadnezzar's ropes. There was no loss to them. They lost nothing of their clothes, their hair wasn't touched, they didn't even have a smell of smoke upon them. So when in the fire with certain possessions, they came out with the same possessions, and they suffered no such thing as failure, loss, impossibility, or defeat. But what did King Nebuchadnezzar suffer? He suffered loss of face, he lost his ropes, he lost his prestige, he lost the lives of some very, very splendid physical specimens, the men who threw them in, and the whole effect of that day was lost when the world saw that one could defy the king of Babylon if he was a worshiper of the true God and come out unscathed that entire experience. And so the whole plan of Nebuchadnezzar was very, very nicely spoiled by what those men experienced. I said before, because they did it entirely God's way, because they gave God the problem, they did not work out a solution for God to fulfill on their behalf, they utterly refused to let the king be their plan maker in the place of God, then they were with God, they're carrying out God's plans, and therefore they could not be losers. And if they could not be losers, then how could Nebuchadnezzar win? He couldn't, could he? Because you can't have two winners in the opposing conflict. One side or the other will win, or at the very worst there'll be some kind of stalemate or standoff in which neither side wins. But I said before, in this case, of course, we have an absolutely clear and unequivocal win for God's side once again. Bear in mind that that victory is the nature of the victory which we have to experience today and tomorrow and throughout the remainder of our lives and throughout the remainder of human history. Because God's folk are to go forth to meet Satan as a conquered foe, and they are to know no such thing as failure, loss, impossibility, or defeat. Right, we'll stop at that point. Another 45 minutes have gone.